All right, Mr. Bring.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would call Mark Rolfus as a witness.
Mr. Rolfus, as you know, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I am required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In other words, generally speaking, a lie. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Rolfus, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Bring.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please state your name and address, please.
Mark Rolfus, and my business address is 215 South Cascade Street, Fergus Falls, Minnesota.
And for the record, could you spell your last name, please?
My last name is spelled R-O-L-F-E-S.
Thank you, Mr. Rolfus. By whom are you employed, and in what capacity?
I'm employed by Ottertail Power Company. I'm currently the manager of generation development, but I was a project manager during the Big Stone 2 project.
And what is your educational background?
I have a Bachelor's of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering from North Dakota State University. I'm also a licensed professional engineer in the state of South Dakota and Minnesota.
And what is your employment history, Mr. Rolfus?
I've worked for Ottertail Power Company for almost 33 years. I started at the Big Stone plant as a plant engineer. I then was a electrical supervisor, responsible for the electrical and control systems at the plant. Then I was the plant engineer at Big Stone for 14 years. Three of those years, I was also the plant manager of Ottertail's Hoot Lake plant. And then from 2001 until September of 2009, I was the Big Stone 2 project manager.
A few moments ago, did you hear Chairman Kramer ask a question about whether a joint scrubber was required?
Yes.
Are you able to answer that question?
I think I can. The simple answer is no, but that's not telling the whole story. When you begin the project, we would not have had to build a joint scrubber. But as we evaluated the best approach, we decided on a permitting strategy that was that the emissions at the entire site would not increase. And because of that permitting strategy, we had to participate in a joint scrubber between the existing unit and the new unit. And there was good rationale for this on the permitting side, but there was also good rationale on economics at that time based on what SO2 allowances were going for and the economy of scale of building a larger scrubber versus a smaller scrubber, and the likelihood that Big Stone 1 would have been required at some future date to have a scrubber on anyway. All things considered, the joint scrubber made sense, and once we made that decision, then we had to proceed with a joint scrubber.
And Mr. Rolfus, a few moments ago, did you hear a question from Commissioner Clark about whether Ottertail paid an exit penalty in connection with leaving the Big Stone 2 project?
Yes, I did.
Are you able to answer that question?
Yes, I am. And again, this is a longer answer than you would probably want. When the developers of Big Stone 2 came together originally, there was a tremendous amount of concern about a utility getting in and being a participant in the project for just a short period of time and then leaving. So the owners decided to structure an agreement that made it difficult for a utility to leave. Not impossible, but difficult. In fact, the original ownership agreement, the party, a single party could not leave unless the cost exceeded the original project cost estimate. And the project was being developed in the time frame of 2005, 2006, when all construction activities were seeing rapid increase in cost. So because of those costs, we tripped the trigger that allowed a single utility to leave the project at a prescribed time. And at that time, though, there was a penalty. And when GRE and SMMPA left the project, they did pay an exit penalty The two of them together was almost $2 million, plus the loss of all their assets in the project. And the agreement was structured that the longer a utility stayed in the project, the less that exit fee would be. So at the time that Otter Tail left, and there was really only these two opportunities, Otter Tail did not pay a monetary penalty, but they did, in effect, pay a penalty because they had to release all claims for any money that was in the trust account and for any of the physical assets, the land, office furniture, and such. So Otter Tail didn't pay a monetary penalty, but they did lose some of the rights and assets of the project.
Thank you, Mr. Rolfes. Perhaps the commissioners will have follow-up questions later on. Did you supervise the preparation of the original Attachment A to Otter Tail Power Company's petition for deferred accounting?
Yes, I did.
Your Honor, the petition for deferred accounting was made a part of the record, of course, and I don't intend to ask questions of that. How is revised Attachment A different from the one filed with Otter Tail Power Company's petition for deferred accounting? And I'm referring, of course, to the revised Attachment A that was made a part of the settlement agreement that was filed on April 23, 2010, and which has been made an exhibit in this hearing.
The revised Attachment A is different in that it covers a longer period of time, and because of the longer period of time, we were able to mitigate some of the expenses, and there were some errors found in loading rate for one of the accounts, and there was also some moving of expenses from one category to another to try and get them in the right bucket, so to speak.
Mr. Rolfes, referring you to the revised Attachment A that was made a part of the settlement agreement, could you describe the various categories of cost incurred by Otter Tail in connection with developing and permitting Big Stone 2?
The task of summarizing these costs are difficult because many activities, in effect, could go into more than one bucket. They were done for more than a single purpose. And if you look at the project from a very high level, there were really two activities: developing the project, you know, getting participants, getting agreements, figuring out what you're going to build, and the other activity was permitting the project. So you've got some activities such as engineering that are done for both. The engineering work was to establish cost estimates and what we're going to build for the development phase, so the utilities knew cost and what they were getting into, but it was also necessary to for the permitting phase to know what's going to come out of the stack and where is it going to be and what the quantities and qualities of the emissions are. So a lot of these expenditures fall in different buckets. So to try and simplify things, we've grouped the expenses into seven different categories. The first one, engineering, procurement, and construction, is really the money that was paid to our primary engineering firm to design the plant. But that effort was, like I said, for basically two purposes, you know, costs that fed into proceedings and information for the environmental permitting. Then the next one is what we refer to as project development team labor. It included all of the internal people that worked on the project, like myself, and any outside consultants that were hired to assist in any phase of the project, whether it was on the engineering side where we hired some consultants that had a lot of experience in doing this, or on the public relations side or communication side. Then there, we tried to divide up into another bucket, you know, permitting an environmental impact statement, and this is the cost to actually do the work for the federal EIS, the water permits, the air permits, and the certificate of need. And then there's legal. And, of course, the legal was actually involved in many of these other activities. And
Mr. Rolfes, excuse me for just a moment. On the permitting costs, were there interveners in any of the cases involved?
There were interveners in almost all of the proceedings.
All right. Was that true of the Minnesota Certificate of Need proceeding?
Most definitely.
And how many interveners were involved in that case?
In the Minnesota Certificate of Need, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy represented four environmental groups: the Union of Concerned Scientists, Fresh Energy, Wind on the Wires, and the Isaac Walton League.
And what about with respect to WAPA's or Western Area Power Administration's development of a federal EIS and the eventual record of decision?
Well, because the EIS was the last permit that was gotten, we haven't had a legal challenge, but along the process, there was many opportunities for public comments, and all of these groups commented, which Western had to take into account as they did their environmental impact statement.
What sorts of issues were they commenting on?
Well, the whole range from the from water, air, CO2, I mean, any of the current issues out there, they use the opportunity for someone to make comments, and Western responds to all comments that they receive.
So they considered environmental issues even in interconnecting with the Western Integrated Transmission System?
Western just happens to be the lead agency. It's a federal environmental impact statement, and the federal environmental impact statement was triggered just because of the electrical interconnection with a Western substation. But because it was triggered, they look at the entire project. Anything the project touches basically falls under the EIS, even though there was only one single event that triggered the need for it. You know, they look at everything at the plant, everything on transmission, every potential aspect, including, you know, local community effects and such. They were all looked at. It was an all-encompassing permit, environmental impact statement.
Okay. I apologize for interrupting you. A moment ago, you were segueing to the legal component.
The legal was another bucket trying to divide the cost, where we put attorney's fees and such, but these were for a number of purposes, for developing all the project agreements and defending and procuring all of the permits and determination of prudence, even, were part of the legal fees. There's another category of other expenditures, and these were the monies that were spent to purchase land, office equipment, paper, that. And there's a fair amount for the groundwater investigation. We did get a groundwater permit, and to do that, we had to put a number of holes in the ground as test wells and pilot holes and such to assess the availability, quality, and quantity of groundwater in order to do that permit, and that was a major expense. Item 6 refers to our earlier discussion on exit penalties and such, and there is the credit that, in effect, Otter Tail received from the exit of GRE and SMMPA. And finally, there's the AFUDC bucket for the cost of money, basically, during the duration of the project.
Thank you, Mr. Office. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Samico.
Just one, Your Honor. Thank you. Mr. Rolfes, you referenced the cost of exiting for Otter Tail, and that was, in essence, walking away from the assets and the monies and trust account. Can you estimate the approximate amount?
The largest amount was from the land that was owned, and as that land has been liquidated in such a rough number, is total, not Otter Tail share, but total, there's about $2 million. Otter Tail share was roughly a quarter of that, or they funded a quarter of that.
Okay, thank you. I've got nothing further.
Mr. Bratton.
Mr. Rolfes, a couple of questions. You mentioned there were revisions made to Attachment A at some point, and can you just explain a little bit about what prompted those revisions and why they were made?
The biggest reason is because the passage of time. When the original Attachment A, Otter Tail owed for any of the obligations made prior to its exit. So there had to be estimations on what those costs were. And with the passage of time, those estimates were no longer estimates. We got the actual numbers, and we estimated high. Plus, with the passage of time, some of the obligations were mitigated so that Otter Tail no longer owed them. I mean, one of the examples is commitment to buy land, and because of the unwinding of the project, that commitment was no longer required of Otter Tail. So with the passage of time, we've been able to eliminate some of those costs. And there are still a few costs that are unknown as we wait for the final bill, so I would guess there could easily be a $10,000 adjustment, probably lower to the actual final number.
And if I recall correctly, I think you also mentioned that some items were moved from one category to another. Can you explain why that was done?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, trying to decide where a cost falls is difficult. And just as we went through it, we said, well, maybe this item should have been in, you know, permitting and environmental instead of under legal or something. So we didn't change the numbers. We just changed where they were, trying to be more consistent with where we divided the cost up. I mean, we didn't have seven accounting items for the project. We had many, and we had trying to simplify this, we took them and grouped them into the seven. And as we reviewed it, some seemed, well, maybe it's more appropriate to be in this bucket instead of that bucket.
Okay. I have one more question, and it's related to how you're, you know, placing these costs into different categories. And I'll just explain what I'm referring to and ask you to just respond generally to that. And the main one would be the permitting and environmental impact statement and the legal. And you explained that there were interveners in these permitting proceedings, and you also have, though, another category for legal, and I'm interested in the relationship between these permitting proceedings and the legal. And, for example, there's, I believe, under the permitting, there's a reference to filing fees, and sometimes in private practice, the law firm will pay filing fees and bill for them. I'm wondering, you know, how these things like that were allocated between the different categories there.
Okay. To the best of my knowledge, for all the filing fees, they did not go through a law firm. I mean, you know, the cost to do the certificate of need in Minnesota or the advanced determination of prudence and such, I think those were directly to the project. And in doing any one of the permits, and let's use the air permit, there is a large effort by an engineering firm to actually submit the permit, and that would be in the item three. But the law firm that had to go through the public hearing and present it and such, you know, that would be number four, legal. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
Maybe I can ask it more directly. Would the legal be only actual invoices you're receiving from private law firms?
I believe so. Double check. I believe that's...
Was the number for legal calculated essentially by adding up the invoices from the private law firms helping out with these proceedings?
That's a little oversimplification, but basically, yes.
Okay. And you have all that documentation, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay. I have no more questions.
Ms. Bendish?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I have a couple of questions. The staff attorney's time on the advanced on Big Stone, whether it's advanced prudence, was allocated here or generally in the last rate case.
If Mr. Bring was doing work on the project, it would have been under what we refer to as item two, project development team labor. It would certainly not have been in the rate case filing, as it was billed directly to the project.
So does that apply to all of the labor? The Otter Tail Company labor would have been allocated out of whatever was included in the rate case?
It's like my labor, which was almost 100% on this project, would not have appeared in the rate case. It would have been in this as a capital project.
Thanks.
Questions from the commission? Commissioner Kalk?
Sure, I'll go first. The question, I guess, of backing up a little bit, you know, you dealt with the folks through this whole thing, and you talked about Commissioner Kramer's question about you're going to put a new scrubber on, you know, the combined emissions out of both plants would have actually been better. We'd have increased renewable capability in that region. I mean, to me, at the end of the day, this would have been a better project for the environment for some of the things that I've seen. Do you have any insight as to why the folks were so adamant that this not be built?
Well, I'm rather biased. I was a project manager who spent 8 years of my life trying to develop the project. I mean, there is, as an example, the air permit was opposed by the Sierra Club, and the Sierra Club has a goal, objective, whatever, to oppose any coal project. I mean, it's, you know, and they opposed the air permit because that's their stated objective. Didn't matter if it was Big Stone, if it was a plant in North Carolina, they're opposing coal projects.
With the kind of following through some of the questions about the legal expenditures, the overall expenditures, so can you take the roughly 40% of each one of these costs, it would be a North Dakota share, if you will? Is that the kind of the way we looked at it? I would assume that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that, kind of walk this through, that you would have spent more time satisfying a Minnesota concern than 40% of the time in a certain area, that the Minnesota ratepayer should pay higher than a 40% in a certain cost?
Let me try and put that into perspective. I mean, we're basically talking the permitting activity. And if you look at the permits, the most expensive permit was the Federal Environmental Impact Statement. It was a permit, the activity, I mean, I refer to it as a permit, but it's needed to go forward. It was the first permit we started and the very last one we got. So, I mean, it took the longest period of time, and you know, we could say the federal government should pick up a piece of this because they move so slow. You know, then the next, you know, I mean, that's an editorial comment, but, I mean, the most expensive was a federal EIS. Then the next two most expensive permits to actually obtain was the Minnesota Certificate of Need, which kind of relates to your question, and the air permit. And granted, I think the Minnesota process is more cumbersome and slower than the North Dakota process, but really I believe, and I think we could substantiate this, the reason that those two were the most costly is because they were the most vigorously opposed by the most well-founded oppositions. Well-funded opposition. Well-funded opposition. If you look at the air permit was opposed by the Sierra Club, which has a large coffers to oppose this and brought in national attorneys to oppose this. And the Minnesota permit, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy exists just to provide legal services. And there was large national groups, you know, environmental organizations funding that. So Minnesota may not be as efficient as North Dakota, but we really spend more money there because of the opposition and the fact that GRE and SMMPA pulled out and we had to, in effect, do it again a second time.
Okay. I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Any further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Bring?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Samacol?
None.
Mr. Brutt?
None, Your Honor.
Ms. Bendish?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rolfes. Mr. Bring?
Your Honor, we would like to...
We would like to ensure that we've answered all the commissioners' questions, and I believe there was one question that Commissioner Kalk asked about energy price forecasts. And we do have available Mr. Brian Draxton, the manager of resource planning at Otter Tail Power Company, and we're certainly willing to call him and to address those questions.
All right.
So I'd call Brian Draxton.
Mr. Draxton, do I pronounce your name correctly?
You do.
Mr. Draxton, as you have heard me advise previous witnesses, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I am required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In other words, generally speaking, a lie. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years, or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Draxton, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Bring.
Please state your name and business address.
My name is Brian Draxton, and that's spelled D-R-A-X-T-E-N. And my address is 215 South Cascade, Fergus Falls, Minnesota.
I hate to ask you to do this, Mr. Draxton, but would you spell your first name, too, in case there's any question?
E-R-I-A-N.
There was.
And by whom are you employed and in what capacity?
I'm the manager of resource planning for Otter Tail Power Company.
What is your educational background?
I have a BS in accounting from Morehead State University, along with a minor in business finance.
A few moments ago, Commissioner Kalk asked a question about energy price forecasts. Are you able to answer the question whether these are regional forecasts?
Yes, it is a regional forecast based on the price at the Minnesota hub.
I believe that it was Commissioner Clark that asked about natural gas prices earlier in the hearing. Were you present during that question?
I was.
All right. Were there appreciable changes to the natural gas forecast from the spring 2008 timeframe to the fall 2009 forecast?
While there was a lot in the news about new discoveries of natural gas and the recession and everything, our experience would show that there was not a significant price drop in our forecast for natural gas through 2024. And while we do have a recession at the current time for a short period, I believe, you know, this is a long-term forecast, which looks at things like future usage of natural gas. And while there may be a bigger supply, I think you're seeing we're expected to have a lot larger usage for natural gas into the future for things like electric generation, since it's so difficult to do coal or oil.
Earlier during the course of presentation, there was a discussion about marketplace changes. Are you able to describe some of the ones that you're witnessing?
Right. You know, I think we have a couple of major changes that we've seen in the market for electric energy. First of all, MISO has brought a very significant change to at least our region. MISO does have a lower reserve margin than we used to have under the old MAP scenario. We also used to use a load forecast that was to the 95th percentile, and now we are required by MISO to use a 50% confidence level forecast. And the other thing, I think MISO, which it was intended to do, was to bring efficiencies to the market. It has really done that. And we've seen the prices in our region for both capacity and energy reduce significantly. And I think the second most significant one is the addition of wind, especially wind, but other renewables in the area. In fact, in a American Wind Energy Association, the 2009 annual report, they state that over 10,000 megawatts of wind was installed in 2009, which was the largest in history, which was almost a third of the total wind power that's available in the United States. And as we all know, there was significant additions right here in the state of North Dakota.
I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Sabico.
I have nothing, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Bratton.
Just one question. You're speaking about the price forecasts, and Mr. Bring presented a PowerPoint earlier, and there's, you know, it shows, generally speaking, a rise in the cost estimate in the coal market, and I'm wondering if you can just speak a little to what the sources of that rise in the cost estimate would be.
First of all, if you remember when Mr. Bring described those in his opening testimony, he was very careful to say they were generic coal options, not specifically our Big Stone 2 option. In resource planning, I like to say we live in the theoretical world and not the real world. And we use a capacity expansion model called Strategist, which I believe Excel uses, and it is kind of the standard in the state of Minnesota for us to do our resource plan by. What the numbers you see in front of you include is, based on the data that was available at those times, we tried to look at a 8,760-hour year. That's how many hours are in a year. And if we were to, the coal option would say, if we were to cover that whole year with a certain capacity of coal and some market purchases to make up what the coal wouldn't do, what's the all-in cost? In other words, the levelized fixed cost of the capital and the variable costs and the fixed O&M cost. And we did the same thing comparing that to a combination of wind and natural gas and the market. And based on the numbers that were available for 2008, as you'll see in the graph there, the wind gas option was higher than the coal. When you go to the lower right-hand corner of that slide, you'll see that going to 2000, I believe it's, I can't remember how that slide is headed, if it's 2008 or 2009. But the lower right-hand corner, you'll see that that has flip-flopped, and now that coal had become more expensive and the wind-gas combination had become less. And I think there's reasons that occur in both of those columns for that. Number one, on the coal side, the capital cost increased significantly for the cost of coal, and I believe that that's the biggest impact there. And then the other side, there was a small decrease in the cost of natural gas along with lower cost of installing wind capacity. In the earlier time, there was such a demand for wind turbines, and we saw the price for wind capacity just going up steadily. And now we see that that has turned and even maybe reduced somewhat because of a lot of the capital constraints. We're seeing less demand on the turbines themselves.
When you say, you said that the capital cost increased for coal and then there's a lower cost for installing the wind energy for those reasons, why was it that the capital cost was increased for coal?
I think what you saw then was just a general run-up in commodity prices, steel and copper and cement and those things. It was just that general run-up of prices.
Was that related to the economy, downturn economy, anything like that, or just market fluctuations?
I would say at that current time, that was due in large part to the changes in the economy. The commodity prices, though, have not seemed to tick downwards. They've sort of stayed at that increased level.
I have nothing further.
Ms. Bendish?
None, Your Honor.
Ms. Jessica Zacko?
No, Your Honor.
Follow-up by the commission. Any further questions from the commission? Commissioner Clark.
Referring back to that slide on whatever page it was, 11, I guess. This is estimated all-in cost 2008-2009. Do you have similar information related to projecting further out 2020-2030?
I don't have that with me today, but it's something that I could provide.
Did Otter Tail do that sort of analysis as well? I mean, you'd have to, right? I mean,
we do. And in fact, as Mr. Bring talked about earlier, we are filing our integrated resource plan in Minnesota on July 1st, and North Dakota will receive a copy of that at the same time. And we will have information that could allow us to make up a graph in that exact format. That particular information in that format may not appear in that IRP, but we could do it very easily.
Sure. Actually, if you would submit that as a late file exhibit, I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm sorry, Commissioner. Are we at, is there a, what page, what
oh,
slide?
Oh, it's the slides on page 11 of the handout refer to changes in energy price forecasts back in what they look like in spring 2008. And then in 2009, and I guess I was on, maybe it might just be a clarification on my part. I was assuming this was, these were cost estimates for this installed resource alternative as of that year, 2008 or 2009, but weren't projected costs for future years, and typically in IRP planning that's done. And so I just appreciate that on a going forward basis.
You know, we supplied them the way we did here is we were simply trying to show how it changed our decision with regard to Big Stone 2.
Sure.
As far as the late filed exhibit, would you like to see that for every single year through 2024, or should we just pick a few select years throughout that time period?
I would just pick a few select years so we get a sense of the trend.
Okay, can I have, please, a short description for the exhibit?
I would say the exhibit that appears on page 11, it would be similar to that where we would provide that graphical information for future years out as far as 2024.
So it would be changes to energy price forecasts in future years.
Reference to the data that
we used. All right, for the record, Mr. Bring, counsel, that will be Exhibit 5, OTP 5. as a late filed exhibit.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Bring.
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Savico.
Just one more question with respect to that page 11. My understanding of that before the last comments on that were that this was present value analysis of the two resources, which would mean the life cost brought to today's dollars. Is that what this currently shows?
You're right, and that's a good point. Oh. And I apologize for that, because as I rethink that, that's a good point. It really doesn't make any sense to do these year by year. They are a present value of 2024 back to today's cost. And I apologize for not understanding
okay.
that. Very good point.
So what I understand is it would include the fuel cost, 2009, 2010, up to 2024, all of that present value to today's dollars.
Okay. In that case, I don't need the exhibit. You can scratch it.
So the exhibit five, for the record, exhibit the proposed late filed exhibit five is withdrawn.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Brett.
Nothing further.
Ms. Bendish?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeff Goatsack.
I do have a question for Otter Tail, but not for this witness. I can ask this witness, but they're going to say, no thanks. So if we take a 5-minute break, maybe I can talk to Mr. Bring, and then we can figure out if I have any questions.
All right. Assuming Mr. Draxton, that the further question is not, in fact, will not, in fact, be directed to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be in recess for 5 minutes, please. 5 minutes, if we can.
No, I have a question.
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Just asking.